So, Berto, have you seen The Room? The famous, terrible, you know, it's the most famous terrible movie of all time, I think. Have you seen the movie The Room?
You mean Room? Like, where it's, like, scary with the mom and the...
Well, have you seen that, actually?
No, I haven't.
Okay, it's actually a really good movie.
I heard it is.
Yeah, but have you seen The Room?
You mean that horror movie, The Room?
Yeah.
Yes, I have.
Well, I thought in this episode we would... I know you did, because we actually saw it together. You dragged me to it, and I enjoyed it.
Kicking and screaming.
And so I thought we'd talk about that. I also thought we'd talk about Tommy Wiseau and Greg Sestero and their relationship. Because,
Greg Sestero.
Because it's portrayed in the new movie, The Disaster Artist, by James Franco. And, and he produced and directed and that sort of thing. So what do you say we do that today? We analyze Tommy Wiseau definitively. What do you say?
Psychology of Tommy's Room.
Yeah.
I love it.
This is the Psychology in Seattle podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Kirk Honda. I'm a therapist and a professor. Who are you, Berto?
My name is Humberto Castañeda, and I run a little flower shop in San Francisco.
Today, we have we have two special guests with us back on the podcast, the Unpopular Culture podcast people. Future Dr. Michael Drain.
Hello.
And maybe a future doctor, Corey Stewart.
Oh, I like it.
Yeah.
Sounds good.
Is it that they're the unpopular people from the culture podcast?
Yeah.
Yes.
Okay.
Yeah.
So are there better people in that podcast that we should be inviting?
No.
Yeah.
More popular people?
No.
Yeah. The podcast is actually just called Culture, and these are the unpopular version of the culture.
That's exactly
right.
Like
The Room, we are hilariously bad.
I see.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So I thought I would ask a bunch of questions of y'all and just get your individual responses. But before that, I just want to provide some caveats. We're going to spoil both movies.
Like a lot.
Both The Room and The Disaster Artist. Although, you could have spoiled these two movies for me, and it wouldn't have affected anything.
Right. What if I had said, he's going to pat the dog's head? Wouldn't that have ruined the whole thing?
Also, I just want to say a huge caveat to all this in that we're going to get into conversations about Tommy Wiseau's personality, and since you and I, Drain, are clinicians, we have to say that we have no idea who this person is. We've never assessed him, and it's all filtered through the media. Now, Berto and Corey, you can say whatever you want because no one can sue you for
completely off the hook.
Yeah, making false statements about people's personalities.
Yeah, I love being the layperson.
Yeah. And so just keep all that in mind, that all the data we have on his personality is through movies and interviews and guest appearances. And if it's anything I know that is very questionable data, particularly when you have a guy like Tommy Wiseau, who is very much aware of the fact that he's on camera and very much is trying to portray himself in a particular way. But I think we can say some things about his personality. But anyway, before we get to his personality, let's just overall, Berto, what do you think of The Room? Did you like it? Did you not like it? What's your relationship with the movie?
Bluff.
Okay.
Is this a tougher bluff?
Not it is quite. Not.
Okay. Then let me think this. Oh, yeah. So overall, when I first saw it, I was totally blown away with laughter. Like, I haven't laughed that hard in a
while.
When
did you see it the first time?
Earlier this year, like before the summer or something like that, in May, I think it was.
So you're not an early adopter.
No. I had, you know what though? It turns out I had seen that poster. Do you remember that they mentioned that he had taken out a billboard on Hollywood for 5 years or something?
5 years?
Yeah, for 5 years. That thing sat there in one of the main areas. It must have cost him a fortune.
Why would he have put it there for, like, hoping DVD sales or something?
No. It was always playing at least at one theater at midnight.
Oh.
And it had his phone number or something. But the weird thing is, when I first, my friend Ron invited me to go see it, I saw the poster of it.
Because didn't Ron see it back in the day?
No. Oh. No, he also, not back in the day, but he did discover it not too long ago. But he's like, hey, you need to come with us to go see The Room. And I'm like, okay. And I saw the poster, I looked it up online, and I was like, oh, I think this is that horror movie I heard about, and I don't know why it looks so familiar. And now I've pieced it together that I used to go to LA for work all the time selling my flowers, and I used to drive probably that route.
So how many times have you seen it?
By now I've seen it 2.5 times.
And do you like it?
Oh, I love it.
What would be your rating out of 10 Birdos?
Yeah, I'd give it
or maybe you have some weird convoluted system, like out of 13.5 Birdos.
No. It's 3.141592 out of 10 Birdos.
It's Pi Birdos?
Pi Birdos.
No, seriously, what number?
No, I mean, I would probably give it I mean, okay, if I was evaluating it like in a vacuum as like movie quality, I might have given it a 1. But entertainment value, it's like, I don't know, like an 8 worth of entertainment value.
Right. For me, it's the hardest movie to rate because it is the most definitive 1 out of 10 that's ever been made.
Yeah.
It's like the worst of the worst. It's terrible. It's worse than some of the movies I've given a 1 rating to.
Yeah.
But at the same time, it is well worth watching.
Highly entertaining.
at least once, particularly in a crowd of people who are all enjoying it with you.
Right.
Now, I will say there are 3 different ways to watch it. You can watch it by yourself, which I think would be entertaining in and of itself. 2, you can watch it at one of the crowd movie theaters the way we all did last week. But that's a different experience because you can't really hear the dialogue and everyone's screaming and they have to have the subtitles at the bottom because otherwise you wouldn't be able to know what's happening. But that's fun. But then watching it with friends in your living room, I think would be a different
another experience
because then you can actually hear the dialogue. And stuff.
I've done like the first time I saw it was in the big crowd, but we were sitting really close to the front, so I actually heard most of the dialogue. Unlike when we went where we were in the back and.
Yeah.
You know, a lot of it wasn't heard.
Did you get hit with spoons when you're?
Yes, totally pelted with spoons. And then the second time I watched it, although I didn't finish watching it because we had to turn it off and stuff, was with friends, and that was also fun.
Yeah.
And this last time was with the crowd.
So before I go to Corey and Drain about what your ratings are, I just want to say if you don't know this movie, you've probably seen some clips or memes or something. There's a man with long, dark hair and kind of a pale face. He has sort of a
vampire.
Sort of a vampire-ish looking face. And there's 2 infamous scenes, one where he's saying, "You're tearing me apart, Lisa." Or the other one is,
"I did not hit her.
I did not hit her.
It's bullshit.
It's bullshit. It's not true.
I did not hit her. I did not.
I did not.
Oh, hi, Mark.
Oh, hi,
oh,
Mark.
Oh, hi, Mark.
Yeah. Which, by the way, I'm predicting that, like after Austin Powers and Borat, all the douchebags were quoting this for years to come. I think we're.
I've already started.
Yeah. Somehow I lived through 2003 and completely missed this movie. But yes, I'm sure it happened.
Yeah. So Corey, let's just go. Let's do a different horn system this time. What did you think of the movie? Because you'd never seen it before.
Right. I just saw it very recently.
Had you heard of it before?
Never in my life.
Had you seen the memes?
No.
So you went in completely dry.
Totally blind. Berto said to me that it was a horno.
A horno.
And so
a
I
horno.
Got my popcorn and my red wine and it was great.
And what'd you think as you were watching it?
It was bizarre. As you were talking about like the 3 different ways that you could watch it, I would say like definitely don't recommend watching it by yourself. And I thought the only way to do it was how we did it with audience interaction, screaming. Maybe I wouldn't appreciate it unless all these people were there.
You gotta have it.
Like my friend Ron said that the first time he was watching it was like at home by himself and he thought it was stupid.
Right.
Oh.
But... I think once you get...
He said he was drunk, too.
Well, okay, that may not help. But,
but so Drain, what do you think?
This turns into a performance piece, basically. You have the interaction of all the audience. You have to have that. You have to have people throwing spoons, and when certain actors walk in, they all start chanting their name. I also didn't know what this place was. Walked in completely blind. He told me it was a horno, and I was like, oh, God, here we go. And
How did you interpret that?
How do you interpret Birdo?
I thought we were
like you just kind of go okay, cool. So we'll
I
see.
Thought we were at a really hip like Capitol Hill theater that was just trying to be like ironic and show like a bad movie,
right?
But the audience interaction was like, where am I? Like, did I just am I supposed to be here?
Well, and the reason I told
like a
him,
club.
So the reason I told him horno is because I wanted to first of all let them know or misdirection about it being a horror movie. So I said, like, it's kind of a horror movie because it looks like, you know, when you see the guy's face, you're like, I think that's a horror movie.
Aw.
In fact, the whole feedback he kept getting early on when he was trying to be an actor was, you should be a villain, right?
Right.
But then I think as I was telling them that, weren't they showing scenes and some of it was like, they were showing scenes before the movie started.
Yeah,
and some
it
of it was
sex
like
scene.
The nudity, sex scenes. And so I was like, oh, yeah, it's like a horno. You know, porno.
Dude, thank you, because that suspicion of just constantly waiting for someone to die was weird. It put me in like a weird place to watch that movie.
Right.
Yeah, it really does not match the poster because it doesn't have any horror in it at all.
No.
Well, the first thing was that delicious interview that they played. They interviewed Tommy Wiseau.
That was weird.
The first thing I saw. I thought it was the movie, and I was like, and he's like, so why did you? And they're naming they're trying to give him like gotcha questions, like, so why did you name it The Room? And he will give this long, kind of rambling answer as if he's making it up as he's going along with the motivation of impressing the person he's talking to.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Why would you name it The Room? Makes no sense. And two, why would you market it from the beginning, before it became a cult or a so bad it's good movie, why would you market it with his face just sort of, you know,
right?
Looking at the you know, camera, that iconic was so face.
Right.
He just thinks he's being sexy.
Yeah,
but it's coming off as like really intense.
Yeah, as like horror,
and, like, scary.
Yeah, I totally agree because I actually, like I said, I had gotten it confused with maybe a few different movies that I had heard about. So in my mind, I was like, oh yeah, I've been meaning to see that movie. It's like a horror movie, right? And Ron never corrected me, of course. But you know, when the movie starts, I, like you, was probably, I don't quite remember now, but I'm imagining I was like waiting for the, but immediately it's evident I have not walked into a normal movie.
Right.
I thought it was going to be a legitimate movie. Like, yeah. I was like, okay.
Yeah, I thought that interview was part of the movie because I didn't know why it was happening or that just, it was like, yeah. So old.
And then that turn, that slow realization that this movie is something very wrong.
And everybody knows, different. And I'm on the outside of the joke.
Yeah.
That interview that you were seeing, that was from the DVD. They were like playing extras from the DVD.
I see.
Nice.
So I just want to mention that there's another movie that I would say definitely contends with The Room as the best bad it's good movie.
Oh my
it's
gosh.
Called Miami Connection. another foreign non-American guy decided to make an American movie. I think he's from Vietnam or China or something.
What do you mean?
Are you Tommy confirming that Tommy's not American?
Yeah. Wait, what?
He apparently did confirm it on accident.
He's from New Orleans.
Yeah, he was giving an interview with James Franco on Conan or one of those.
It was Jimmy Kimmel.
Jimmy Kimmel. And then he's like, so where are you from? And he's like, well, you know, I'm originally from Europe, but, you know, I went to New Orleans. And James Franco, who I was listening to an interview of him today, he was like, didn't call him out, but his mind was exploding. He's like, he's never admitted that.
Yeah.
I mean, so that's another thing. If you don't know anything about Tommy Wiseau, is that basically this guy appears out of nowhere and has this, and is very shady about his past and never wants to talk about it, but claims that he grew up in New Orleans, which is supposed to explain his accent, but it clearly is not a Louisiana accent. And people would say his accent actually is less than it used to be if you
is
hear
it?
Him talk.
Yeah, that's true.
But if you think about how his accent was before he even made The Room, you know,
right.
It would have been. And they think he's probably from Poland, is like, that's where they're placing his accent.
I see.
And he is in California, and he's also claiming he's about 20 years younger than he probably is.
Yeah.
Like at the beginning of the movie, he says he's 19 or something.
Right.
Yeah.
Same age as you.
Yeah. I'm your age, man.
Yeah. And he has millions of dollars.
What problem?
That's no problem. That's fine.
Yeah. And he has millions of dollars that he claims he made selling jeans.
Don't worry about it.
Which is not likely. Which points to potential nefarious means, right?
Like,
everything's going to turn out okay.
Yeah.
Now, I suppose it does, but that's not where my mind went.
And he decides to make a movie because he's having a hard time getting acting jobs. And because he has all this money, he just funds this movie and writes it himself. And and he just strong arms this movie into existence with his with his money and his will. But he has no one helping him. There's no one helping him with the dialogue. There's no one helping him with directing. There's no one helping with the technical side.
They try.
They try, but he doesn't. It's so haphazard, and it ends up costing $6 million to make the movie. But when you watch it, it looks like. I mean, people say like it looks like it was made for $60, but honestly, like if you think about paying like
all the camera work, all the
you got to figure like I don't know $200,000 maybe or something.
The cancer treatment,
yeah,
especially when you do things like build an alley instead of using the alley, which actually happened.
By the way, there's an online rumor that or you know some people that actually are like, you know what, he might actually be Dracula. Because, you know, the thing's like, you know, he's got this Eastern European accent. He looks like Dracula. He looks, I mean, sure, he's looking older, but he could be thousands of years old. He's got all this mysterious bottomless pit of money. And, you know, he comes from New Orleans recently, which is probably where Dracula would have led. So they're like, actually.
Well, geez, spoil my whole analysis of his personality. Why don't you?
Oh, sorry, I still got some stuff.
Just joking. But anyway, so let's go around the horn. Why is this movie good? Because... It's hard to explain. Understand how a movie could be. So, Miami Connection is similar to this.
Uh-huh.
So, Corey, why is this movie good?
It's good because it's like gif-able, like you were saying. It's so memeable, and that's probably the only thing that it has. Other than for me personally, I would give it a 10 because it's like exponentially good. It starts really, really bad.
But why is it gif-able?
But each time you watch it, it's amazing.
Why is it gif-able?
Because they're so bad. Everything that he says is so funny.
But there's
funny.
A lot of bad things. You know, like, I was thinking about this because if you watch like a bad telenovela or something, those are bad too. Like if you just, or a bad soap opera or a, you know, you're watching it and you're like, man, this is awful. I don't want to watch this. It's laughable how stupid this is. But
still on like level two compared to this.
But you don't want to go to a midnight showing of All My Children, you know, bad episodes of General Hospital. What is it about this movie that makes it so bad and also so good? Do you know what I mean? It's sort of a weird thing to put your finger on. You just know that it's good.
So, yeah.
Like to me, there's two aspects that might help explain it. One of them is, so you guys are probably familiar with the term the uncanny valley when it comes to representing a human being. But if you're doing it, let's say you're doing a 3D graphics human or a robot or something, your mind is so attuned to real human faces and emotions and things that if it's not quite right, you start feeling sort of uneasy, like, oh, it sort of looks human, but it's kind of creepy.
Are you saying that you're able to pick up that they're not genuine? Because
like in a normal, like when you see
like an
android
way.
And it's not quite right. Yeah, like your mind just knows and it feels uneasy. So I think a lot of times when movies are not good, they ride that uncanny valley between being good and being bad. So they're trying and they just, the lines, they don't just don't deliver. But so what you feel is you feel uneasy. But this movie crosses right over that uncanny line and goes all the way to another extreme. So you don't have to feel uneasy. You could just like be there like in wonderment of how this even came to be.
All right, I'm going to explode. I have to talk. All right. So it is that it takes itself too seriously.
Yeah.
It's how seriously they're trying to take themselves, which a soap opera would do too, right? So what's the difference there? They're adding all this other stuff. And honestly, I don't think we would have had the same experience if the four of us had been sitting around at home watching this compared
to... Right, can I just interject that like the power of suggestion is huge here?
Right, exactly. So I think a big part of it is the way that we saw it. We saw it in an interactive way where the whole audience was in on it. Right. They were all shouting lines along, Greg Sestero. And then they were like throwing spoons. They had one scene where they rewinded it like 5 times. That honestly, if I had just been watching it at home drinking a beer with you guys,
would have missed it.
Probably would have completely missed it.
Interesting.
That's why it's gif-able. They're short and quick.
Yeah.
I'm sure you could do this with All My Children, but it wouldn't, as much as it pains me to say, I think quality wise, All My Children is probably somewhere above.
But you see,
and Tommy's personality attributes to it. When you recognize like who he is as a human being, it's like so cool to poke holes at the entire movie.
Yeah, see, this is, I do disagree on this a couple of fronts. First of all, I did have the experiment of trying it with people, not at the communal theater, but just couple people watching on TV, and I didn't prompt them at all, and they were laughing their asses off.
Nice.
Now, that could just be them, to be fair.
How many people were there?
Just like three.
You and three other people?
No, me and two other people.
Okay.
Now, and I was the only one who had seen it. Now,
wait. Hold on. What was the setup? Did you like sit him down and were you like,
okay,
have to watch this movie?
Oh, okay.
And it was like, they didn't look anything online. I didn't tell them, oh no, but it's because of this. Like, I just said, you have to watch this movie.
Okay.
Now, of course, I was laughing too, but I wasn't like leading them in the laughter. You know, but that's just my first point. My second point is this. All the examples with the soap operas, things like that. Take a scene like when Greg Sestero says, oh, this girl dated these 12 guys and then they found out about each other. They beat her so bad she ended up in the hospital. In a normal quote-unquote bad movie, the next reaction is, oh, that's terrible. And then you as an audience member feel the uncanny valley of like, that's not very
right.
good.
The tone is off. He's a little culturally off. Right. Maybe it's not entirely cultural.
But in this case,
he's a little off. He's a little tone deaf to his own script that he wrote.
Exactly.
And that's one of the one of the layers on there, too. So it's the bad writing. It's how off he is. So what you're talking about, there's a scene where he's talking about how this girl was beat up in an alley. And it's, you know, obviously the reaction would be, oh, my God, I'm so sorry, or sucks,
right.
or whatever. Instead, he just busts up laughing.
Right, but that's what I'm trying to get at. It's like, in a normal bad movie, you would have a quote-unquote correct reaction, but just poorly acted, or the words are not quite right.
That's a
good
call.
This guy doesn't say, oh, that's too bad, whatever his name is, Mark.
Yeah, so you're essentially controlling everything but that.
That's crazy. What? That is so beyond uncanny. Like, that's like... alien. That's like an alien said that.
Yeah.
And so I think that's part of what makes it just inherently funny.
One. The one where they all stand around and toss around the football. That happens like, what, two or three times throughout the movie. And I think that may be what people think Americans do when they all stand around and talk.
Yes.
You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Who knows?
Yeah, that's a good point. It's the...
He calls it playing football.
Right.
Which
it's playing football.
It's not playing football.
No.
It's tossing a football very close to each other.
Yeah.
Right.
You know, you're just like 5 yards from each other, just kind of tossing a football to each other.
Well, and then there was there's the choices of like during the acting and the directing stuff, but the editing also made choices. And for example, there was that whole scene of them quote unquote playing football in their tuxes, right? And as if you watch the movie, at first you think, oh, this must be the day of the wedding.
Yeah, yeah.
Right?
You must just skip
That's
forward.
True.
Yeah, yeah.
Or, and then it's like, no, it's not the day of the wedding. And that never gets explained.
Yeah.
They weren't trying on the tuxes. Yeah. It's completely unexplainable.
Yeah.
Yet in the editing, that just slipped right in, you know?
Yeah, I think...
Oh, my God, you're right.
I think you're all right. I think it's gif-able. I think the Uncanny Valley thing, I think, does make sense. But I think the main thing that I focus on is what you're saying, Dre, in terms of the cultural divide, and this is actually one of the things that I think is a problem with the fact that you have a bunch of Americans just laughing their asses off to this. I was laughing my ass off to this movie, but afterwards when I was trying to figure out why is this so funny. And after a while, and I haven't heard this connection, I'm sure people are making it, is it's sort of like a real-life Borat.
Right.
Yeah. You know, Borat, Sacha Baron Cohen plays a man from a Eastern or, you know, Southeastern country, European land that doesn't understand Western culture, comes here and is trying to fit in, and he's trying to interact, but he's always screwing it up. And it's hilarious because he's a stupid foreigner who doesn't understand this. But it's I'm saying that, you know, in quotes.
Yes, of course.
But it's also funny because he is also bringing out people's sort of bad side, you know, like he'll bring out their racist side, like throw the Jew in the well. Do you remember that from the movie? You know, and all these Southerners in America are singing along with this, you know. And so there's a number of layers to it. But one of the layers is what a, you know, stupid, podunk, rural, out of touch foreigner, and aren't foreigners from this particular part of the world funny and stupid, you know?
Right.
It's similar to like Chrissy on Three's Company. It's like, oh, aren't ditzy blonde women funny, you know?
Right.
And so So when we watch Tommy Wiseau, he's a real life Borat. He is actually from a faraway land. We don't know exactly where, but somewhere that clearly doesn't really understand Western culture. Or an even worse proposition here is he's intellectually disabled, which I want to actually bring up as a possibility.
He did mention his accident.
Right. Yeah. Well, or he just is born that way, because not everyone from, you know, Eastern Europe is that clueless to West. I mean, there's a lot of, you know, for example, Polish artists who totally understand how to, you know, not make a movie like this, let's just say. And so there are two. So there's two things that I think is hilarious to watch, is because, like, as soon as, especially if you know he's from another country, especially if you know he wrote it and directed it, and, you know, and you're like, look at this foreign, ridiculous human. Because you have to admit, that's a major element of the comedy. He's a foreign, ridiculous human trying to act like he's not foreign and trying to act like he's not ridiculous,
right,
when he is so ridiculous. And I hate to put a, you know, a bummer.
Way to bring a snake all over it, Kirk.
Wet blanket.
But
no, but you're right.
It's still funny. I mean, I'm still laughing at it, but I'm just saying that I think that is actually the main thrust of the humor.
You know, when I was living in Colombia, there were many humorous shows made in Colombia that would feature a token gringo.
Yeah.
And he was always made fun of in a gringo way. Okay. He was like a sort of a comedy relief sort of character.
Yeah.
And it was usually, you know, he would talk in Spanish like, hola, yo soy de los Estados Unidos. ¿Qué pasa aquí? And he was usually tall and lumbering and sort of didn't get the humor. And, you know. It was,
yeah, they do the same thing in Japan.
Right.
They have entire comedy shows for Japanese people in which they get an American on the show, and the American tries to speak Japanese and tries to do things on the show. And it's just hilarious because it's basically an entire country laughing at a foreigner who can't do things in their language and can't do things in their culture. But, and I think the room, when we watch it, I think there are other elements to it, because it's also just, I think another element to it that we haven't mentioned yet is that there are bad productions, and then there are like bad art that's made very, you can tell that there was a lot of money spent on this thing. You know what I mean? It's like, but money spent all in the wrong ways.
Yeah.
You know what I mean?
Yeah, because it still comes out looking like the abstinence video from church I had to watch that one time.
Right. But you can tell, like, oh, that set is expensive. And that
just the wrong kind of expense.
And they have lighting, and they actually have crane shots. You can tell, like, there's cameramen actually, you know, it's not just like someone holding a video camera. So
There's an unnecessary amount of actors in the and actresses in the movie,
because he had money but no organizational ability to spend it properly.
Right, which we see laid out in The Disaster Artist, which really just seeing The Room and then The Disaster Artist right afterwards was just like the best movie combo I've ever seen.
It was great.
I will say, though, because I think you are onto something. At the same time, like the characters I was mentioning in Colombia, those are played by actors trying to be that ridiculous. Borat is played by an actor trying to be that ridiculous. But Tommy Wiseau is a real person.
Right.
Yeah.
Now, maybe that makes it worse to laugh at him.
So let's forget about the foreign aspect, because I think that's relevant. But also, let's imagine that, because he appears not to have the sharpest tact.
Yeah, I want you to go back to the intellectual disability. What kind of where are you seeing that?
I mean, you know, people like to speculate as to which or whatever.
Yeah,
I'm just gonna say there. And again, I've never assessed him, and God knows he could be the biggest genius on the planet, given, you know, what he's done.
Right.
But I think one could make a case that there's a strong hypothesis and some data that suggests that he's not the smartest person.
Yeah.
You know, he has a lot of drive. He wanted to be an actor. He wanted to make a movie. But he has a hard time figuring out the right thing to do. I mean, who shoots in HD and film on this when everyone...
Buying the cameras.
when everyone around him is like, why? Like,
you can't even light it correctly.
So it's the bad decision, but then it's backed up with... He always has this like reaction formation type defense mechanism where he kind of goes like... Well, I just did that because I wanted to. I meant to do that.
Right.
Kind of his answer for everything.
Right. But when you pile all the decisions and his reaction, again, we're looking at it through Greg Sestero's book that was made into a movie.
Right,
that
which was, then you got to consider his motives at the time you made that.
That was so has said is 99.9% accurate, which I find also to be funny because there's no way that movie is 99.9% accurate.
He would say that, though, because he's the kind of guy who would just say shit, you know, because it might sound good in the moment.
Right. He wants people to see the movie because it furthers his career and all likelihood, again, speculation. But anyway, my point is that who makes a movie like that, then releases it thinking it will be nominated for an Oscar? I mean, you know, there's narcissism, which we could talk about as well.
Yeah, that's not what this is.
That's not narcissism. No, that's like you're not making connections.
It's almost like a inferiority sort of. Like
so it could be a psychological issue, and that's definitely another hypothesis. But I think there's evidence for he has a low IQ or some cognitive problems that lead him that you could when you look at everything that he did. A lot of the things you could see is like, oh, maybe it's a result of low IQ, which is, again, if that's true, then another reason why it's sort of a problem that we're all laughing our asses off at.
Yeah, that's true.
Now, he's laughing his self to the bank right now. So it's not
And he actually has been, because as I listen to more interviews and stuff like that, the movie shows that at the premiere, everyone laughed and that he changed his perspective. I thought that was an exaggeration. Like, oh, clearly that wasn't that. But what I've heard is that he actually immediately embraced, like you're saying, how he's like, oh, yeah, I meant to do it that way. And he immediately started promoting himself and the movie in that way as a cult sort of underground thing. And then it actually got in rotation across the world for years. So we're coming super late to the party because tons of audiences have actually been watching his movie for years. Now, that shows some kind of ability to plan and comprehend that's not quite consistent with what we think of him from having made that
but
movie.
If he had the money that he had, if he has a low IQ, it's probably in like the 80s or something. It's not particularly low.
No, but it's not. We're not talking 70. Yeah, we'd be talking like 80.
It'd
85.
Be something that would like affect his decision making and his ability. And but with all that money, he would be able to just kind of wander through the world and do shit and see what works out and whatever doesn't. It's fine.
But it does require a little bit of, because you see a lot of movies that go terribly bad, and you don't see the directors necessarily, the whoever's. React in a way to embrace that and sort of make the best out of it. I do have one theory, though, which is that in the movie, this may not be real, right? But in the movie, remember, he says, I got in an accident and that changed my life. Like he was doing, you know, he was just wandering around. He got in a bad accident and that made him want to go back to his passion, right?
Yeah.
So my hypothesis is he was a little more normal. And he got in a really bad accident, got a big settlement that gave him a lot of money,
but
he also lost some brain capacity in the process.
But is it possible he could have gotten $10 million out of a
depending on the accident?
One accident.
Depending on the accident.
I mean, is that possible?
And we also don't know if it was $6 million, right? That's the rumored figure, but we don't know. But I do know that like the way that was put in the movie was not just like, yeah, I got an accident. It was like, I was in an accident that changed my life. And that sounds like a bad accident.
And Lord knows, a traumatic brain injury can have any number of personality changes, all kinds of things.
Because it's not just that he has an accent. He also says kind of slurs his words.
There is a slur there, so maybe some kind of paralysis, or it's possible.
His
it's
eye is lazy. Plausible. He's got a little bit of a lazy eyelid, you know?
Yeah, that's a weird one, yeah.
Yeah.
Oh, that's true, though. So, like a Bell's palsy sort of thing going on, maybe.
Right. So we have to take a break, and when we get back, let's analyze his personality. What do you say?
All right.
Okay, we're back from the break. If you haven't become a patron of the podcast, do so now. Go to patreon.com. When you become a patron to the podcast, you don't have to listen to all the stupid commercials, which is kind of nice, and you get access to all of our premium episodes. And you can also go to patreon.com to become a stalker for the Unpopular Culture podcast, as I am.
Hell yeah.
Oh, thanks,
that's
Kirk.
That's right. Thank you, Kirk.
You get early access to things and exclusive access to some behind-the-scenes kind of interviews and stuff.
Did you get your posters, by the way?
Yes, I did. They were signed by you guys. Didn't I text you? Like,
no.
I thought I texted
How
you.
How do I become a stalker?
I waited all day, but no.
Just kidding.
How do I become a stalker?
It's Patreon.
Patreon. Oh, okay. But you guys call him
we
slash.
Just try to be flashy about it.
I forgot to do it. So it's my bad.
You guys made an amazing episode recently on Slender Man.
Thanks, man. Appreciate that.
It's been interesting to see you develop your style as a podcast. And the Slender Man episode, I thought, was as I was listening to it, I was just so impressed with the whole thing. And you've really set a high bar for every episode beyond this.
Ooh.
I hope you realize
yikes.
That.
Wow.
You know, so like not only was it well written and like had a really great storyline to it, you know, the whole Slender Man thing and the two girls who killed their friend. But you had like great music that was unique, I think. I don't think I've ever heard that style of music on
that's
a podcast.
That's because I wrote it.
I know. But like, but the music, you know, the choices that you made, I thought were very unique, you know, and it was like sparse and like appropriate to the mood making and the interviews that you included. I mean, that always takes a ton of work of just like pulling those audio files and like fitting them in the right place. And because, you know, you probably had to look at hours and hours of footage.
So much.
So like, okay, which one do we include? You know, interviews with the kids, interviews with the prosecutor or whatever. Anyway, so I thought it was amazing. I don't envy you, though, because now every episode you make basically has to it requires hundreds of hours of work now.
Yeah. I know. So we can't help it.
Should I start adding music to our podcast? Like, we're talking.
Well, but it has to match the mood.
Yeah, that might bring it down a bit.
So if we're talking
that's better.
If we're talking about Tommy Wiseau's personality. Oh god.
No.
Show my butt.
Colder.
Shut it down.
My ass.
Shut it down. Abort. Okay, so let's talk about Tommy Wiseau's personality. Again, it's all basically from The Room, from some interviews, and also The Disaster Artist, which is supposedly accurate. So Michael Drane,
sir,
expert of personality, what can we say about his personality that we haven't said already?
So I hadn't actually considered the intellectual disability until Corey had brought it up to me earlier today. And when she first said it, I dismissed it. I was like, no. And then as we've been talking about it, I could see how it would be mild. It could be there. Yeah. It could be mild.
Well, so it could be mild, one, in terms of a global G, as they call it. But it could also be a capacity to understand social cues, as they say.
Yeah.
Or even like how to think through things when you're emotional or something.
Right. But there's also, and Berto accurately pointed out, he's got some actual physical things that look like there could be some paralysis there, which is... He had a brain injury, apparently, so that could be it.
Yeah, yeah.
He might have had a brain injury. He had an accident.
The guy just says shit, so you don't really know. Yeah. But so there's definitely that. That would impact his decision-making and seems to. He doesn't really seem to... If the movie is to be believed in the way he's portrayed, it's about he just kind of wanders through life. He's got an apartment in L.A. He's got an apartment in San Francisco, which would be super expensive. So he has money, and he doesn't really seem to have a plan. He just kind of does things. He makes friends, and then the way I think he's got some attachment stuff going on. My theory is that he...
Well, so after we watched The Disaster Artist,
yeah,
which maybe we should just briefly touch on for a second, we walked into the aisle, and you turned to me, and your body was physically... animated with, I could tell you had sentences behind your body jerkings. You're just like, oh my God. But in your head, I could see the gears turning like, wait, we're going to podcast about this. So maybe I should hold this sentence in. But I want to say so. I want to hear that. But let's talk about the movie, The Disaster Artist. Berto, how many Bertos out of 3.14 would you give The Disaster Artist?
Oh, first of all, I give it 9 Bertos. And second of all, do you guys know we missed the end of credits scene?
Oh, there was.
What? Tommy Wiseau.
Yes, I know. I read about that, too.
Oh!
And Greg Sestero.
What happens? Yeah.
I know what happens. I don't... Do you want to...
Yeah.
Okay, it's just a brief scene where James Franco, as Tommy Wiseau, walks out of some of the theater or something, and then there's this character that the real Tommy Wiseau is supposed to be playing, but Tommy Wiseau was like, I'll wear these glasses and I'll paint mustache or whatever. But it's obviously him, you know, but he's playing this character and he intended for that scene to be in the movie. So he like wrote it into the contract that that scene had to be in the movie, but he intended it to be like part of the movie. And then they're like, we can't use this except we'll put it at the end. And apparently they have a little brief conversation. I don't know all the details, but James Franco goes like, where are you from? New Orleans? And then that's like the joke there. But I haven't seen it. I just read like what it was about. I really want to see it.
Drain, what do you think? How many drains would you give this one?
Oh, jeez. I would give it the most endearing one.
Wait, no,
the disaster artist.
Eight.
Okay.
Like a strong ass movie.
What'd you like about it?
I don't know. So, Corey, you were saying that this is Franco's breakout role. Wasn't that something?
I read that.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay, I agree with that.
He did a great job nailing Tommy Wiseau. I don't know. It was funny. It kept me entertained the entire time. What I liked about it was the same reasons I liked The Room, because it's this really awkward situation. And having just watched The Room, it was almost like an explanation behind the scenes DVD special about what the hell that was.
Right. I think I have another reason why we love these two movies, actually, is because everyone loves to see people spend money. At least I do. I love to watch people spend money. Like if someone has millions of dollars, it's just fun to watch them like waste their money.
Drop it like a tide.
You know, it's Always Sunny in Philadelphia. Is anyone watch that TV show? Frank, you know, he's always like wasting his money. It's funny to watch a rich person spend their money. Anyway, Corey, how many Coreys would you give this one?
Damn, I think it was so good. I think it was very well made. It was close to the story. I think that my timing of watching the two together was perfect. I love that I didn't really know anything about filming The Disaster Artist and that I researched it afterward. It has been really cool, though, to see like how involved James Franco was in like learning about Tommy, especially as we've been talking about like, you know, kind of being careful with it. And I think that The Disaster Artist did a really good job at not just laughing at him, because there is a lot to laugh at, but it's like there's not, like, he told his story so emotionally and so well, and to hear and to read like how connected he was to the character, or I'm sorry, to the person that Tommy is, and then like see the scene side by side. I thought that was a great ending. I thought the start of having all the celebrities there, like, oh, The Room is amazing, that was a really cool intro.
Yeah,
you're totally right. There were some heartstrings tugged at the end there too. It wasn't just
watching
a total
bashing of this guy.
There were some moments of empathy where it really puts you in his perspective.
Yeah, like
especially
when Berto said
end.
That he was Dracula, I felt sad because The Disaster Artist made me feel like he didn't want to be seen that way, right?
Yeah,
like
when
he
you understand
to be the hero.
This guy's motives and how badly he wants to be accepted.
Yeah,
and then he's like increasingly not accepted up until this climactic moment of the movie where everybody is laughing at him.
Yeah it could have easily been a kind of frat boy make fun of this guy movie, right? But as you're saying, it pulls at your heartstrings. It definitely is a heartwarming story in this very peculiar way. You know?
So I think they make Tommy look really good too, like especially at the beginning, like you said, frat boy, like I assume you're talking about like, oh, hi Mark, Greg Sestero, and he's there as this like kind of vanilla protagonist, and he needs all this confidence that his new friend has.
Well, I mean, frat boy, like, haha, isn't it funny how stupid this guy is? And just make that, because like James Franco and Seth Rogen, you know, they're kind of like that frat boy humor, you know, and this movie could have easily just turned into like just a silly parody of the guy, you know?
Yeah, that's true.
But it actually,
they put some heart into it.
Yeah, but it actually has a character arc to Greg and to Tommy that, you know, is the stuff of actual well-written movies, you know, and it's probably accurate. You know what I mean? Because I was trying to watch it. The one thing about the movie where I was like, that probably is not how it went.
What?
Which was the first screening. And maybe you guys know the details on this, but like he made the full transition from, oh my God, everyone's going to make this is going to be my Oscar moment. So in the span of watching The Room from the beginning to the end at the premiere when all the people were there, he went through all the stages, you know. Yeah. He was like, I hope this is going to be an Oscar. oh, people are kind of not, I don't know, are people liking this? Oh my God, now they're laughing. I'm a disaster. I'm terrible. You know, I'm a loser. Greg Sestero comes out, convinces him, and then he gets up on stage and says, I meant it like that. Like, to me, it seems like it would have taken longer for that to happen. You know,
so,
like,
so that was the point
that's
I was
what
making,
Berto was saying.
Which is that I thought the same thing, but in listening to the interviews and what you were saying that he...
That's what he does.
What Michael was saying
is that... That's his go-to defense mechanism is, oh, I meant to do that.
Yeah, and actually...
Oh, I know so many people like that.
According to Greg Sestero himself and stuff, he basically... Immediately switched gears and capitalized on the opportunity.
Really?
Which is why it makes me wonder just how unclever he is, because how able to like self reflect in the moment or something.
Greg Sestero walked him through that process. He didn't do that on his own.
Yeah, in the movie he did.
Well, I have a speculation on that too that we can get in terms of attachment, but just, you know, it's 2020. It's like, man, he's a genius. But imagine up until the premiere. Think about everything up until that point.
Of course.
I mean, we're talking like stupid decision after the next. I mean, just in the script alone.
No, I'm saying nothing about genius at all. I'm saying simply that I would expect someone the way he seems to be to have taken years to get over that.
Well,
demolishing
let's get into the main hypothesis, which I think was what your wiggling was happening at the end of the movie, which is that he's borderline.
Borderline.
Right. Yeah. And I read your mind in that moment. Now, I've said this on the podcast before to you listeners out there. For some reason, I'm either seeing borderline everywhere, because I have a pretty broad definition of the personality, and the DSM label is reserved for a very extreme particular subtype of borderline personality overall. But also, my other supposition that I've talked about before is that movies and TV shows love to portray borderline for some reason. Hmm. There's
Do you think they understand that that's what they're doing, though?
No, I don't think they know. Well, I don't think they're setting out to be like, I'm going to portray borderline. But, you know, The Cable Guy, Girl Interrupted.
Oh, so good.
You know, there's something about someone who is so desperate for a friend and so awkward and gets so overreacts to minor rejections. There's something very compelling about that sort of personality.
And yet, how much can we blame this on Hollywood if this is supposed to be an accurate portrayal of a real guy?
That's
what
true.
Do you mean?
The disaster artist.
The disaster artist is based on a real person. So how much can we really say in this case? Although I completely agree with you.
Yeah.
Especially
as far
like
as Cable Guy and Girl Interrupted.
Oh, I see
and all
what you're
that.
Saying.
But in this movie, Tommy Wiseau, it's a based on true events sort of thing.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Right. So I was thinking about that too. And The Disaster Artist is based on the book written by Greg Sestero.
Right.
Right.
And there are so many hallmarks of borderline throughout the movie that are from the book, that are from Greg Sestero's, you know, memory of this whole thing, that make me think that it's pretty accurate. You know what I mean?
And they're specialized hallmarks, because you're hearing it from the point of Greg Sestero, which would be the equivalent of hearing it from the person of, like, when you're in a borderline's life, you experience that in a very unique sort of way.
Right.
And so his tellings in the movie, the way they come off from his point of view,
right.
And there's
is the way I'm seeing it.
There's codependencies between
them. Right. Yes, the stalkery sort of qualities where he can show up sometimes and he gets super attached. He's very fast to rejection. And,
right. Right. And
all over the place.
From what I understand, the book has much more of it, actually. Because James Franco wanted to make Tommy Wiseau likable, essentially.
Yeah, I was going to say, one of the reasons I think the Disaster Artist movie does not feel like it's just poking fun at Tommy Wiseau is James Franco did not start from seeing the movie. He had never seen the movie. He read the book, and he was so taken with this story of this friendship and this, like, dreamers and all this stuff that he's like, I want to make this story. And then he watched the movie, and then he kind of got the joke and got into it. And that's a very different way to start that project. Because you could imagine, like you were saying, someone that's just seeing the room endlessly is like, dude, I got to make a spoof of this or something, right?
Right.
But that's not how it started.
Right.
And actually, he pointed something out, James Franco did, that was that, you know, we were talking about, like, why do we find it so entertaining or so compelling? And he was saying it's not just because it's a ridiculous movie, but it's because there is heart in the center.
Yeah.
Like, Tommy Wiseau, you can say anything you want about him, but the guy is an honestly passionate human being.
Although not to confuse with an honest human being.
Yeah, this is fair. He's an honestly passionate human being. And that comes through, even though it comes through in a sort of distorted way that maybe we shouldn't make so much fun of, but it is there.
Yeah, so this might be as good of a time to throw this in because we've been talking about it. Tommy Wiseau, when the book came out, Disaster Artist, initially said that it was 40% accurate.
Right, yeah, I read that too. And then he said the movie was...
Then he said the movie was 99% accurate. Now, you got to consider the arc of what was happening. In 2003, this was a huge joke, and nobody liked it. And then it slowly built fame over time. Then the Disaster Artist book comes out, and it frames Tommy in probably a pretty bad light by what you're saying, Kirk. It has more borderline kind of stuff in there, so not favorable things to Tommy Wiseau. But then you fast forward to now, oh, the movie's 99% accurate. Well, that's convenient because it's doing really well, and it's making you look good.
Right. Well, it also makes him look bad, you know? And so it's interesting that he would allow that, you know what I mean? Because I don't think many people walk out of that movie going like, Tommy Wiseau, man, he's a stand-up, nice fellow. You know what I mean?
Yeah, like, that's true.
The movie, for a pretty solid amount of the time, you're just like, Jiminy Crickets, Wiseau, like, calm down. Like, give Sestero a break. I mean, especially that scene where Sestero's moving out with his girlfriend, played by the woman from The Community.
And from... Mad Men.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And whom I love.
She's
hilarious. But... I've heard her on podcasts. She's on like the Nerdist sometimes. Anyway, and him are going to move into a place together, and they're talking about it. And so this was one of those stories where I was like, it sounds so believable given the pattern that had developed prior to that. You know what I mean? So Wiseau gets really upset. You know, he's just that feeling of betrayal, like. How dare you? Now, the facts are just like, well, it makes sense. Sestero is a straight guy. He, you know, just went to LA to live at his place because he didn't have anywhere else to go. Now he has somewhere else to go. He has a girlfriend. They're still friends. They can still, yep. Wiseau and Sestero can still be friends. But because he's moving out to someone who has been relationally traumatized as an early child and abandoned, any movement away, and this is kind of a big one. I mean, when a roommate moves out of your place, especially that
to
small,
follow the dream together,
a small little, like barely bigger than a studio apartment that was always behind a curtain. But a nice sort of vampire curtain.
Yeah. Vladimir.
It feels like a hurtful distancing act, and the person feels very betrayed, and then they get very hurt, and then they get very angry,
and then they lash out, which is what Tommy Wiseau does.
Have we haven't mentioned the homosexual possibility,
right? Which we can, but I mean, do you have any data on that? Because
I'm only going from the movie, from the Disaster Artist.
Yeah,
in that, not from the room. In the Disaster Artist, they seem to hint. First of all, we never see Tommy with a woman other than in the movie.
Or with a man,
that's fair. But we do see him very obsessed with Mark, or with Greg. And they throw that line in, which it may just be in the movie, of course. But they throw that line in, it's like, I want him to see my ass. I want you to see my ass. Right? So I was thinking, like, maybe he's got romantic feelings towards Greg, and that makes everything harder.
Yeah, I mean, that's definitely a possibility, given the data. Did you have data?
Just anecdotal. I've had patients that have, they hardcore borderline, they balance the line of, they attach to somebody. In this case, it was Greg Sestero, and it can become so close. They want that intimacy to be so close that they're willing to cross lines. They'll want to snuggle in bed. They'll want to be very physical, hold hands, that sort of stuff. But outside of that relationship, they haven't traditionally been, you know, homosexual or whatever.
Good. Yeah. Corey, what do you think? Do you think Wiseau is bi or gay?
I don't know. I have no idea. Watching The Disaster Artist, I had the same hunch that Berto did, especially when he was like, what, you don't want to share a bed with me? You know.
Kidding.
But there's really no way to tell, I don't think.
Yeah, to me, it's like, could be.
Could be, and doesn't really matter.
Yeah, it's like, because the story felt to me, at least the way it was presented in the movie, as friends, you know.
Yeah.
Wizzo never, according to the movie, never right. over, and Sestero probably would have written about that if it right. happened.
And The Room was based on a heterosexual relationship.
That's right.
That he wrote
nailed it, Corey.
About.
That's so
well,
true.
Was it though?
Yeah, right. And well, who's the real maybe. Life Lisa? I
so
wish
I
she
thought
existed.
That, yeah.
So that's the other part of this
right.
is that when you have been relationally abandoned as a child, and then you grow up and you engage in relationships, whether Lisa was a stand-in for a man or a woman, doesn't really matter. The point is that if you just look at the way he wrote the Lisa character,
right.
it's a classic borderline projection of all you do is use me. You never cared about me to begin with. You're having sex with my best friend. My best friend doesn't even really isn't good to me. I should kill myself. What's the point? Now, I have a lot of listeners who label themselves as borderline, so I'm not saying that everyone is like this, but
it is a spectrum.
It's a spectrum, but the point is that when you are relationally abandoned and betrayed as a child, you have actual PTSD and trauma reaction from that. Then when you engage in a relationship and the person starts to kind of move away from you, you write a story about that other person because of how horrible you feel on the inside. It feels so bad. I mean, it feels bad for anyone to be dumped. You know what I mean? Whenever any of us get dumped, we have hurt feelings and we start at the very least for a temporary amount of time, we'll write a very negative narrative of the other person.
But for a borderline, when they put all their emotions in you, their identity is in you.
Right.
So when you leave, it's ripping out their guts, their soul, their identity,
exactly.
everything they feel like they stand on.
Right, exactly. And so the whole The Room story arc is one of a borderline person who is at the very end kills himself, spoiler alert,
right,
when he didn't have to. You know what I mean? He could have been like, man, my best friend was a dick, and that woman that I was engaged to, I dodged a bullet on that
psycho.
One. Yeah, like what a crazy person to treat me so badly and to basically just be like, she's a psychopath. I mean, she is a psychopath, right? If you just look at her character,
it is interesting because if you analyze the writing, since he wrote the script, there's this part where she's saying, Johnny's so good. He's paying for Danny's tuition and all these things.
Yeah, Johnny is all good.
Johnny's
Lisa
all good.
Is all bad.
Yeah, and then the second later, the same character that's speaking well about Johnny is like, I hate him. I don't like him. So you got to kind of think that's his model of how people, he's doing everything mm-hmm. right and people just without any reason hate him.
Another feature of borderline, the right. black and white thinking and the I'm right and you're wrong and I can't see it any other way because I'm so hurt. There's no other possibility other than you did this to me.
Right.
Like when he was treating the cast, actually when he was treating the actress, again, I know it's just in The Disaster Artist, so we don't know exactly what happened, but assuming that it was sort of like that where he was putting her down, which is another reason, by the way, that my suspicions, is that he's sitting there trying to do a love scene with this woman and he's like, oh, you look disgusting, right? Like, in his mind, that's perfectly reasonable.
She had a mole on her shoulder.
Like, oh, yeah, you have a pimple. Oh, this is gross. And it's like, what? Who does that?
Right.
In his mind, he's like, that's perfectly reasonable.
Yeah.
And it's perfectly reasonable to yell at everyone. But as soon as he sees them talking bad about him, he's this victim, terrible victim.
Right. So men who have borderline are harder to detect because the profile of a man with borderline isn't talked about as often because of our notions of personality and gender. But he had a number of other signs. For example, he became paranoid about what other people thought of him, and then he would film them secretly on set to catch them talking bad about him. So that's another borderline indicator.
Pair that with the hypervigilance that he had to be that paranoid in the first place.
Right, exactly.
Very aware of what everybody's thinking.
Yeah, it's just like, because again, as a child, you were drastically mistreated, you have a general feeling like mistreatment is just around the corner or happening right now and I don't know it. They also will become violent sometimes with partners. So I assume, or just I have a hypothesis, that Wiseau, before the room, had a relationship with someone, I'm guessing a woman based on the, but who knows, and actually did become violent with that person when that person decided to draw boundaries or something.
Wow.
And then, because it's a common, now, I'm not accusing him of that, obviously, I have no
sure,
idea.
No.
But or he was being intimidating or something, you know, because that's one other thing that people who have been relationally traumatized will resort to, because they're so desperate to keep you close that they'll, you know, they'll try a lot of things, and when those don't work, they might resort to actual control through physical intimidation. And men are more likely to do that because they're taught to be those ways, you know. And then, and he, but he didn't, but because of his distorted thinking in that previous relationship, he's like, I didn't, what are you talking about? I'm not abusive or something. And that whole storyline's
in. No, I didn't hit her. I did not. I did not.
Yeah. Which seems to come out of nowhere. You know, I mean,
right.
a lot of things come out of nowhere in the room.
Right.
But that's one of those major things. Like, when did this topic
come?
When did anybody
accuse you of that?
Yeah.
And his character wasn't abusive in any way. It was, hi, Lisa, I brought you flowers. I love you.
Yeah, oh, anything so from my girl.
But that was exactly it. Yeah. He portrays himself as the character as, he's doing everything right, perfectly. Think about it. Flowers.
Well,
saying everything about the princess and stuff. And she, without provocation, accuses him.
When a borderline is sitting in your office telling you the story of what happened to them, that's how it goes.
Right.
They are completely without fault.
Right.
So it's always highly skewed, like there's some awesome person
always,
like he is.
Yeah,
it's like when he goes to the flower shop, she's like, oh, I knew it was you. And then there's the dog that's perfectly sitting there.
Oh, hi, doggy.
And he knows the guy on the street. Yeah.
Well, that's a little different. That's more of the narcissistic side, I would say.
Yeah, because he has this grandiose streak that's probably unrelated to anything. This just want to be a star.
Well, when you are, again, mistreated as a child, you might resort to a section of your consciousness that says, I'm awesome, and I need to prop up myself as an awesome person because other people are treating me like crap. And so I'm going to delude myself that I'm a worthy person, because if I believe what I'm being taught, my ego falls through the floor. So you prop up this narcissistic vision of yourself that is very unrelated to reality, shall we say, because when you were a child, you learned not to depend on reality to give you self-esteem. And so that kind of shows through in the movie as well.
The problem is that your whole identity is in other people. So relationships come and go throughout your life. So whenever those relationships end, he starts back to the beginning. So
his,
just like any narcissist, it's extremely fragile.
Right.
It's
so,
based on what other people think.
Right. So when we go to his actual real life story in The Disaster Artist, we see the same thing. Enter Wiseau in the beginning of the story. He doesn't really have any friends, and he's trying to be something. Something he's trying to be, you know, famous. He's trying to be an actor, you know, he's trying to be James Dean and these other people.
Yeah.
And then he meets Greg Sestero. Now Greg Sestero's personality is a perfect match for the Wiseaus of the world. And that Sestero also lacks a self in a similar way, but in a less outwardly destructive way.
Good point, man.
Because Sestero, and there are a lot of other people that probably bumped into Wiseau during that time and were just like, whoa, whoa, whoa.
Yeah,
like,
too much. Get away.
Yeah, like...
like the dude in the restaurant in the movie.
Right. So he's in the restaurant, and Wiseau's like, you know, let's act, you know? And Sestero's like, you know, because Sestero doesn't have the confidence or the development yet, Wiseau invades Sestero's personality and gives Sestero something to do, you know? Gives him confidence through you know, Wiseau's personality is so over the top that Sestero depends on Wiseau to give him purpose.
And if you look at the movie, that's how he was originally attracted to him, is by watching him kind of freak out on stage.
Right.
And I was actually referencing the other restaurant scene where he approaches a producer for like some sort of industry insider. Yeah,
who was that guy? I know he's super famous.
Judd Apatow.
Oh, right.
But he was playing some random famous or muckety muck or something. And then he goes up to him, tries his usual stuff, and with him, it doesn't work at all.
Right.
He's just like get this guy out
because
of here.
He Judd Apatow has this personality. He doesn't need people in his life. Anybody he has in his life, he's choosing to have in his life, which is like the hallmark of like a solid person. But right. This guy is not like that.
Right. And there are several moments where you see Sestero and you're just like, dude, why are you putting up with this?
You're yeah. right, though. You're nailed it, man. It, you know Sestero what I mean? Has a beta kind of personality. He's underdeveloped. He's living at home with his mom. He's wanting to strike out. He wants to be famous. He's going to acting classes. He has no gateway there. Borderlines are extremely good at reeling you in and making you think that you're amazing and awesome. They've become adept at this because that's how they get you in close in the beginning.
Right, because they desire naturally closeness to make them feel secure and sure. wanted and blah, blah, blah. Right. So I think the move, and we should just, I want to also just throw in there that there's domestic violence essentially happening between Wiseau and Sestero during the Disaster Artist. If we're to believe yes. that the, you know, it's not violent.
Remind
but,
me, what happens?
Well, Sestero is afraid. He's intimidated, yeah. you know,
yeah.
because eventually Wiseau gets, particularly Sestero, but a lot of other people dependent on him in terms of his paycheck. And then he proceeds to abuse. In fact, I think that's another thing they toned down for the movie, which is that Wiseau was like way worse on set than they actually portrayed.
Yeah. yeah.
He could have been recreating some kind of family
yeah.
network trauma.
Right. So not only do you want people to be close to you naturally, but you also have all this inner anger and resentment and rage regarding your childhood that needs to be projected onto other people. And so you get people dependent on you through paying all of them, including your best friend Sestero, giving yeah. him a place to live.
Right.
And yeah. then now you have power over him, and now you can actually play out that reenactment of being
and Wiseau is a pretty solitary guy, if it's to be believed. He makes one friend at a time if he has anybody. So I think the movie set almost might have created like this family that he was able to reenact aggression and anger and hurt feelings and take them out on these people who I think he was hurt from a relationship, but I don't think that would have been enough. I think he has probably some childhood stuff as well.
Oh yeah, absolutely.
Like abused twice, you know, traumatized twice.
Well, the main personality genesis was mistreatment as a child
sure.
and all. But not so bad that he's not hospitalable, you know what I mean?
Yeah. I can relate to the Yeah, like when he's trying to pay for not only his movie to be made, but sort of like for everyone to do what he wants, right? Like I can relate to that. I'm pretty sure I've talked about this before on the podcast, but we were just talking about the other day about how people retell the same stories. And in podcasts, it doesn't matter so much because you probably haven't heard all the podcasts.
Oh, that's good to know.
But I, you know, when I was younger, my MO was a lot of times, oh, I'll just pick up the tab for everyone. Or I will like invite random people from work that are not my friends to some big dinner. I'm talking about like 20 people or something. And I'm like, yeah, I'll get the check. And thinking in my head, that's how I'm going to connect with these people. That's how I'm going to become friends with them. But consciously, I don't have any intention of being their friends. I don't feel I have anything in common with them.
So why do you do it?
But well, my only theory was like, I had also fear of like abandonment, right? And also I had like from my mom, I had seen her try to address love with money and financial security.
So you saw that's how you got attention. So you're
I think so.
Trying to recreate
yeah.
that.
And I didn't notice it at first, obviously, because, you know, you're young, you're just doing things.
Yeah.
But I remember some friends would point out to me like the worst one was this one time where I had a birthday party. This is before I knew you, I think. Yeah, it was before I knew you. I had this birthday party and I invited, I think like 30 people from work or something. Like it was a ridiculous amount of people. And out of them, I only think I could count maybe 3 or 4 actual friends. And yet I invited them to the Wild Ginger downtown Seattle.
Might it have been your 30th birthday party?
No, it was before that.
Oh.
It was like, I was like 20 something.
Kirk's like, but I went to that one.
Yeah, no, it was before that. And it was at the Wild Ginger. And it was like,
oh, that's like a fancy restaurant.
Fancy. And so I spent ungodly amounts of money on this dinner, and my friend afterwards like made a joke about
it. Did you get
it.
Naked and make everyone look at your butt?
No, not that time.
That was not a pleasant scene.
But you know, but I was like, I was like,
but his butt's better than Wiseau's butt.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah, but I was like, you know, why did I do that? And it was that's when I started sort of like realizing, oh, okay, I think in my head, if I spend money, it means these people will love me or something.
Well, and another element to this that we thought of years ago when I first presented projective identification to you was that you were unconsciously creating a situation in which you were bound to be rejected because you were inviting all these people who one, either they're not close to you, or two, might even be exploiting you because they're just like, well, I don't really know or like that guy, but he's paying for dinner. So it sort of attracts an element, because you would do this at bars too.
So it sets up for failure.
And for rejection of, and for exploitation.
The relationship isn't genuine to begin with.
But then I somehow need that rejection.
Well, you're recreating
the
rejection, exploitation that you felt as a child.
Right.
You know? Yeah. Which, you know.
So I can relate to that aspect of.
Yeah. So let's conclude with future predictions. Like, what does the future hold for Tommy Wiseau?
Oh, I have a good one.
Yeah.
He recently tweeted to please put him in the new Star Wars movie.
As a villain?
No. Well, I don't know.
He wants lightsaber.
He would be a great Sith.
That's a real thing. He recently got a Twitter.
I don't think he's going to have a good reaction to being proposed as the villain. He wants to be like Luke Skywalker.
I think he'll be whoever he can get.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Oh, I hope they make
him rationalize it later.
I also heard on the internet today that he wants to make a Star Wars movie.
Oh,
nice.
What? Please, yes.
Any other predictions? What do you think is going to happen to Wiseau here? Because I think we're at peak Wiseau right now.
Exactly. So, that's what I was going to say. Yeah. This might be his 15 minutes of fame. On the other hand, I guess he's made some movies throughout the years.
Yeah.
And in his way, he's been very famous. I mean, that theater was lit up. People were going crazy for that shit.
Yeah.
That reminded me of Rocky Horror Picture Show. Like when people go see, I've never actually done it, but I assume that's kind of what it's like. Dressing up.
Yeah. But more energy, because the times I've gone to midnight Rocky Horror, not nearly as populated or as energetic as that.
People
was.
Nice. Got up on the stage, dressed in costume of the characters during the sex scenes of the movies, and danced in front of everybody while the sex scenes were going on.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I amazing. Love the part where they're like, what music? What candles? What sexy dress? Because he really did say that, and there literally were none of those things.
Yeah.
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 Well,
so, yeah, I don't know. No predictions, really. But
my prediction is that, yeah, this is peak, and he's just going downhill from here. Because unless he figures out a really clever way to, because he has to keep creating. He can't just, if he doesn't create anything new, like there's a new movie coming out with him and Sestero in it. My suspicion is it's not going
to suck.
It's not going to be amazing.
Yes.
Because they're going to be trying to make a movie.
Right.
And it'll probably be in that bad but almost good zone.
And they'll have that money behind it and producers behind it that will try to make it good and just totally fuck it up.
So unless Wiseau and his people can somehow come up with something very clever, like Sacha Baron Cohen is a genius with this because he had a genius character, Borat, which was hilarious.
Loved it.
And then he had another character, Ollie G, which is a whole other awesome, funny character. And then a whole other funny character, Bruno. And each time it was like, it was good, you know? And I have a hard time believing that Wiseau is going to do that. If he does, good for him. But I think he's on the way down. But here's the other thing. He loves fame, right? Like, I don't think he's going to go down quiet.
No.
So I think that...
Something bad?
Yeah, I predict...
Oh, no.
This is how these stories go, you know what I mean? Like,
shit.
Like 5 years from now, he'll be in prison for...
No. Right. Or worse, he might actually try to kill himself.
Now, listen. I think we're blowing this out of proportion, because let's think about this. In the room, he was probably 35 minimum.
Losing fame is really hard.
Wait.
And
hold
for
on.
Somebody of his personality,
hold on.
He's not going to take it.
Wait.
Personally, I think he was in his early 40s or mid-40s.
Okay, even better. So let's go with your theory. Let's say 40. When he made The Room, he was 40. And remember, at that age, he was already a millionaire. Now, what he chose to do with his money, fine. But he clearly had money. Then he makes this movie. And then what could have been a disaster, ending his career and then going back to bank work or whatever, he instead turns it into this little vaudeville show that he's kept up for years and years. Now at the peak of its 14 years later, is more popular than ever been. They make a movie out of it. He gets even more fame. But remember, he's now in his 60s, probably with more money than when he started. What does he have to, like, there's no, he doesn't need to go anywhere from this.
The moral he's of this, Birdo, well, money, is that money cannot buy you happiness.
No, the moral of this story is, like, which one of us wouldn't kill for that kind of trajectory?
But, I don't know. You know, he doesn't, he obviously doesn't care about money, Birdo. He wants fame.
Well, yeah. Take whatever you want. He wants got the love. Money. He got the fame. He got the love.
But eventually,
and he's already in his 60s.
But eventually, the
he's lived a life.
The he fame, didn't get the love. His best friend said he was a disaster artist.
Well, he gets the public love.
No, and he's been friends with Greg the whole time.
Yeah, because of the disaster artist.
No.
He's James been Franco did him a favor.
But when that dries up, which it will in a couple
guys,
years.
I think you guys are not looking at it through the right lens.
I hope you're right, man, but you're not.
I'm just saying, like, most people in, I mean, 99.9% of the world's population will never have a fraction of the success this guy's enjoyed. Not a fraction.
Right.
Well, you don't actually believe that's a valid predictor of human behavior, do you?
What are you talking about?
Well,
if anything, that's going to mess him up when it goes.
No. What I'm saying is, most of the world goes through their life, you know, but having a job. No one, and then they don't really make their goals.
No one takes into account the rest of the world when they're thinking about their own emotions,
unless they're borderline.
No, but what I'm trying to say is, like, I don't feel anything but like awe and admiration for how his life has gone.
Yeah, agreed.
Yeah, I'm happy for him. I'm super happy
for him.
Even if he does nothing else for the rest of his life, he's already done it. He did it.
Yeah.
So when someone creates, like Francis Ford Coppola makes The Godfather 1, he just stops.
No, of course not.
Okay.
But that's
different. He goes on to make other movies, and then he proceeds to make some bad movies.
Yes.
Then he proceeds to make more bad movies. Yeah. And he just keeps trying to, like, get back to his original glory.
But remember, this is not like a 30-year-old. He's in his 60s, right? He's had a career.
So he's going to die before it matters? Is that what you're saying?
No, I mean, like, well, I'm just saying, like, I don't think this is a little fragile creature we just pulled out of the, you know. He's been in the limelight in his own community for years. And
yeah,
he's
so,
now,
that's one possible thing is, like, he continues to be called to speak at live or at, you know, showings of The Room for the rest of his, you know, years, and that's enough fame jujubee for his, you know, fame bucket.
Agreed.
I mean, another way to look at it is, if he was going to off himself or be depressed, it might have been when he looked at the reality of having spent $6 million and everyone's laughing at his thing.
No,
and it didn't. And he never did, and in fact, he doubled, tripled down on it.
So I want to get back to that, because you mentioned that before, is that's all in line with my very loose hypothesis based on what I see his personality being. This is a different topic that I'm talking about right now, which is that he never wanted to be a respected Hollywood director or actor, or maybe he thought he wanted that. But what he wanted, given his very deep mistreatment as a child, is just the hypothesis, is attention and love, and people just paying attention to him, you know, noticing him. I mean, think about the way he dresses with those belts and everything, you know, that hair. It's like,
looks like Deadpool.
Yeah, he wants someone to like notice him. He doesn't want to be ignored, you know. So that's another movie, Fatal Attraction. That's you know, you could say that's about borderline. You know, I'm not going to be ignored, David, or whatever that line is. And so he's desperately trying to get attention, like, I'm going to win an Oscar. I'm going to win an Oscar. And then when everything falls apart and everyone's laughing, it's like, well, but they're still paying attention to me. There's still a reaction, you know. Everyone still is, you know, the attention is pointed at me, even if they're, I guess they're laughing at my creation. I don't care.
And extremely niche, right? Very few people in the grand scheme of things.
Right. And it's like, but this whole crowd is, you know, that's what they say, right? It's like the worst review on iTunes is a 3-star review, right?
Sure.
What you want is a bunch of fives and like and a bunch of ones, yeah. Right? You know, if you get a 3-star review, it's like you didn't affect them either direction. You know what I mean? And so anyway, so all right, well, that does it for that episode. Thanks for joining us, Corey and Michael Drain.
You are quite welcome.
Unpopular that was awesome.
Culture. If you want to subscribe to the Unpopular Culture podcast, you can go to any podcast application on your phone and type in Unpopular Culture. You could also go to Patreon and become piss patrons,
deserving listeners,
and also stalkers to both of our podcasts.
But Kirk has a ton of backlog stuff that are patron-only episodes that are fantastic. And you want to know psychology, you listen to his show.
But what are you guys going to do after your episode you just did on Slenderman? That's peak unpopular culture.
I don't know if we want to.
Are you guys going to go depressed?
Oh, okay. We're not doing it. Oh, what? It's going to be good, but we're not going to say it yet.
I guess. I don't think we can say it yet.
It's still not here on
Nazi
yet?
No, not yet.
You don't want to?
Not just yet, no.
All right. Well, thanks for joining us out there. Please take care of yourself because
you deserve it.